most delicate microwave transistor I have ever heard about in my zillion years of RF exposure. Let me drop it.
No comments, K6DPZ.
Get to you in a minute after I finish my sentence. That is, there was a, I guess it was a PHEMP FET or gas FET transistor being manufactured by, I'm trying to remember the name of a West Coast company. Anyhow, this transistor operated at something like 150 gigahertz. An extremely delicate field effect transistor that when it arrived, all the leads are carefully shorted together in the way it's shipped to you. And all the person had to do is remove the short circuit on that without first putting it into a circuit and just wave the transistor in the air. And the static pickup in the air was enough to damage that junction. My goodness, was that thing delicate.
Were silicon X?
Good guess. No, it wasn't. I'll think of it in a minute. K6DPZ, K2RJ, go ahead, Hal.
W6DPZ. Okay, I'm just going to mention a very fast and easy, hold on a second, very fast and easy way to check a FET with a VLM. Make sure the VLM is on times a thousand scale, but depending as if it's an NFP channel VLM, put one lead on the drain, one lead on the source, wet your finger, touch the gate. If the ohmage fluctuates, the device is good. Go ahead, Jack.
A nice simple test. Depending on how acidic your saliva is, how conductive your fingers are, you're going to get slight difference. But you're going to see some kind of inflection. You're going to see that it's got activity. Okay, we're at the right time. Essentially on schedule, John, for the mailbag. And give us a quick report. What did you see on the... can't even think of the name of the chart that you look at. Chat room and whatever. Echo link. How many residents did you see? How many emails have you received this week? And are some of these real tough ones where they're going to try to break the bank? KC2WGB with the mailbag and other things. K2LIW and TechNet. You got it, John.
WS2N. FO Manfred with his 40 amp supply.
Yeah, Manfred Morgan Wig. I think you're telling us you've got his name. Is that what you're saying? WS2N. K2RW. Go ahead. You're telling us his call letters?
I know you know that, but I was going to give you the year and a month of QST and all.
Give us the whole works, Paul. You got it.
Yeah, Q2FOD, X-ray Quebec 2, Foxtrot Oscar Delta, December 1998. You might remember it was a two-part series, so he went the next month as well, January 1999. And then they all put it in the handbook, 1999 handbook. And you could find a lot of information about his power supply. Unfortunately, I couldn't find the diagram on the internet. I can give you that. It's a short in the URL.
Yeah, very fine, Paul. So this 40 ampere, extremely well regulated, switching type power supply, protected from overvoltage, reverse polarity, short circuit. Extremely reliable, extremely quiet power supply. I've got a whole lot of emails I had with him at that time where he could literally take the voltage out of that power supply under load and put it directly across the terminals of an HF receiver and turn it across all the bands and find nothing. That thing was quiet and reliable. He needed that kind of reliability because he was the main electrical engineer working for the European Southern Observatory, maintaining a lot of their equipment at their optical astronomy site, and he also was the guy maintaining a whole lot of repeaters on a lot of the mountains in Chile, and he didn't want to have to keep going back to the mountains and repairing power supplies, so he made sure he did a real good job of making an extremely reliable power supply. The main thing that you come away with on this whole procedure, let me drop it, is that you can tune across any ham band any day and you'll find people saying that these switch mode power supplies are terrible, they're not reliable, and they're noisy, and they fail. And yes, by poor design, you can get all of those characteristics. All I'm telling you is that with good design, a switch mode power supply, switch mode inverter, they can be extremely quiet, extremely reliable, and work very well and be very efficient. It's just a matter of choosing the right one with the right design where the engineer worried about all the fine details. So to blame switch mode power supplies for grief means that you're just blaming the ones that were poorly designed. The concept itself, when properly deployed, is a very good concept. Okay, what kind of activity we had tonight on the chat room and Echo Link and whatever, how many submittals have you had tonight, John? KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2IW in the TechNet.
John, one second. I wanted to give you the URL, shorten the URL for anybody that they might not be a member of ARRL. You can look this up on the internet. It's a tremendous amount of information on it, you know, that you can read.
Go right ahead with that URL shortened one, Paul.
Yeah, it's tinyurl.com. That's easy to remember. Tinyurl.com. /07HS8. So tinyurl.com. OOSCAR7HHOTEL8. You might want to read it. It's fun to compare it to the original article. Back to you, and I'll be listening. WS2F.
Very good information, Paul, and thank you. Out of curiosity, Paul, are you the guy that formed that particular tiny URL? Go ahead.
QSL?
Well done. You know, there are lots of people who looked at that design in QST and said, why has it got all those extra components? And when you review some of the material that's available from Mr. Mortenwick, XQ2FOD, and he can justify every component that's in there, why it's there, what it's doing, why it makes it quiet and reliable. So that's an extremely good design, and it's got a lot of history, and people who have built it, and he had to build it the hard way. He can't walk down to Santiago, Chile, the capital of the country, and walk into a Radio Shack, because it doesn't exist, and buy the components. He had to wind his own inductors for that inverter. And so on. He can't even buy coax cable there. He's living in, technologically speaking, a very rough spot of the world, if you know what I mean, and yet doing some very good designs. KC2WGB, to finally give us all of those answers. K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. All right, chat room's rather quiet. Not much going on there, but we have some activity on the Echo Link between 10 and 11, dropping in and out. But pretty active night there. And yeah, we've got a few questions, but tonight they're, I think, going to be very simple and easy and quick questions. But this is what they're asking. Let me let it drop on the first one. Alrighty. This gentleman is asking, he's a little confused. He's got a 5/8 wave antenna that he's using on his mobile, and he has it on a magnetic base, and he's tried it on the roof and on the rear deck lid, and he gets approximately the same results, although sometimes, depending on location, one works a lot better than the other, and he wants to make it permanent now. So he's asking your recommendation. What do you think he should do? Go to the roof or the rear deck? The rear deck is a lot simpler for him, but that's the question he needs an answer for.
Everything in life is a trade-off. Looking at the this in the background there, the best desirable location in the car point antenna, a vertically polarized whip antenna, is the center of the roof, the highest part of the car. When you study the literature, you'll discover that no matter where you mount the antenna, left-hand rear fender, right-hand front fender, center, deck, hood over the engine, whatever, you'll find out that when you plot the antenna pattern at VHF frequencies, maybe even at HF frequencies, the signal is strongest in the direction of maximum mass of the car. In other words, if I mount the antenna at the rear left-hand corner of the car, are producing the strongest VHF and maybe HF signal to the front right-hand side of the car. You stand where the antenna is and look at the maximum mass of car, and that's the direction where you get the best signal. So in order to have the best omnidirectional pattern and the highest altitude to give you the best performance, the best location is the center of the roof. Unfortunately, having the antenna high up like that, it's going to be striking things more easily. And some people don't like the physical appearance of the antenna in that location. Let me drop. And in the case of a mag mount antenna, in my opinion, it gives you a lot of flexibility. When you park the car in a place where you don't want to advertise the fact there's a radio inside, you can take the mag mount antenna off, lay it on the floor behind the driver's seat, in the back seat of the car, so that nothing shows, and then you're not advertising. So I like a mag mount. There are people who believe that a mag mount gives you lower performance than a permanent installation where you really put a hole through the sheet metal. Lots and lots of people believe that. Not true. If the mag mount is properly designed, it recognizes the fact that there's a non-direct connection between the bottom of the antenna and the sheet metal of the car. That sheet of plastic in there to make sure the magnet doesn't scratch your paint when you drop it. That represents an additional series capacitor. A series capacitor creates no insertion loss. It's just part of the design of the antenna. If the antenna is properly designed as a mag mount, or properly tuned as a mag mount, it's going to give you 98% efficiency. So the fact that it's a mag mount does not lower the efficiency. It gives you the additional adaptability that you can remove it when you want to. It gives you the slight disadvantage depending on the strength of the magnet, where when the antenna hits something that's low, the antenna gets knocked down. And there's various ways to protect yourself from that condition. So I'm a great mag mount producer, I'm a great mag mount believer, and I don't believe in drilling sheet metal holes in the sheet metal of my car. That's me. Lots of people have got lots of other opinions on that. So it's a compromise. Anything but that particular location of the car, you're going to get slightly lower performance, slightly less omnidirectional antenna pattern. And there are some people who actually do that as an advantage. In other words, they know that throughout most of their drive in the morning, the repeater they want to talk to is off the front right-hand side of the car. And they intentionally mount the antenna in the rear left-hand side of the car to favor that particular antenna pattern. But that's a rare situation. Those are my opinions on that subject. It's not the last word on it, as you can tell. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGV, well, that's what he was asking for, your opinion. Now he's got it. His problem is he finds it a terrible nuisance to have to reach up and grab it, put it in the car. He'd like to mount it permanently, but maybe from what you're saying, and you're right, I mean, if you bought one of those triple magnet roof mounts, you could hit trees, even with a 5/8, it's not going to break loose from that magnetic contact. So, if he waits a couple of weeks and fools around with it, this is something new, maybe he'll change his mind, but good info. All right, let me drop the nog on to the next one.
Steve, you can do with a comment.
There's one further piece of information I'm going to give you, then I'll turn it over to Hal. Stand by. The coax cable coming from a mag mount, there's an art and a science to bringing that into the car. Some people try to do it through the window, and they can't put the window up all the way. That's not good. Some people do by bringing the coax cable into the gap between the door and the rest of the car, and then bring it straight down inside. Well, that creates a gap around the rubber seal on the door, and rain will be coming in. The right way to do it, in my opinion, is to bring the coaxial cable into that crack above the top of the door, run the coax cable around the perimeter of the door, inside of the rubber seal, outside of the rubber seal, around the perimeter of the door. Maybe you're holding it down with duct tape, and when you get the coax cable down to the bottom of the door, then you cross the rubber seal and bring it across the floor of the car, or underneath the carpeting. As such, you don't get water running into your car because of the coax cable. So there's an art and a science to bringing that coax cable into the car without creating a rain problem. And still, you have the ability to relatively easily disconnect the mag mount and bring it inside the car when you don't want to advertise there's radio equipment inside. So I wonder how you've gotten around this problem, Hal, and possibly you're one of the people who believe that the mag mounts are not desirable. You'd rather do a more permanent installation. K6TPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
URIW and the TechNet, K6DPZ. Well, first of all, the simplest antenna is you put an NMO mount, a nice Motorola Spindle, a beautiful 19-inch spike right in the center of the car. You got 450 and 2 meters is one antenna. You got a 3-quarter wavelength of 450, 1/4 wavelength of 2 meters. And when you take the antenna off, or if your body shop fills the thing up, you go down the road. Go ahead, Nick.
Okay, so you have no reluctance to put sheet metal holes in the sheet metal of your car because with the right kind of a shot doing the fix, I guess the hole can be removed and you can resell the car with no disadvantage. Okay, time to go on to the next one, John. KC2WGB. And mailbag number 2. KC2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good. All right, this young gentleman has a question on headphones. He has multiple receivers, and he has 2 sets of headphones because there are 2 operators. And he's wondering, is it better to connect them in parallel or in series? Because he's worried about blowing the finals on the audio output because of the wrong impedance. They're both 8-ohm headsets, and they work very well. So maybe you can give him a little tip on how to wire that up so he doesn't have to worry about that. And he doesn't use it at high volume. He uses it about maybe 1/3 of volume rate. They sound very good, but he's worried about blowing the finals. So if you could help him out with that one, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
DVZ with a quick answer.
Go ahead, Hal.
Worried about me, they don't have headphones. You tie both of the headphones in series, and then you use some 16-ohm resistor, put it in parallel, so you're still going to have effectively 8 ohms, and your amplifier will be happy.
You've got it reversed, Hal. He's got 2 separate radios, and he wants the 2 radios to feed the headphones simultaneously. Now give him that answer. Go ahead, Hal.
You know, one radio into the other, because your output from one is going to go into the other, and if it's a tube radio or a transistor radio, you're going to damage your outputs. So I would not suggest it, unless you use a matching transformer, where you can feed both radios into a transformer, and then pull up it. But it's not a very standard effect.
Okay, you dropped out about 20% of the time, Hal. I'm going to try to plug in the missing words. You are suggesting that you can't put the 2 radios in parallel. One radio audio output looking into the other audio output is not a good thing to do. There are various ways you can use a transformer that allows you to connect the 2 radios together, both feeding the headphones. I'm convinced there's a way that you can use a network of resistors, which will allow you to have each radio going into the network of resistors, and the common mode resistor is the headphones themselves. So that now each radio sees a reasonable impedance with the right setup of the resistors. The signal from radio 1 doesn't go into radio number 2. They both go into the headphones. So a power divider made out of resistors, I think, would be the ideal solution. Let's see if Hal agrees with that. Hal, you've got to talk softer because you keep jumping out of the machine. K6DPZ, K2RIW for TechNet.
BW Technic, K6DBZ. That's one way to do it, Dick. The other way is if he has two radios, why don't you just use a little relay, and the radio that comes on, the relay closes to that one, or the other radio comes on, it closes to another. Get a couple of read relays, you get away with the whole thing.
Amen.
Yeah, the relays are a much more complicated technique. I know it can be done with resistors. Three resistors would do this beautifully. The right kind of a power divider setup with resistors. The person said, comment, give us your full set of call letters, give us a lot more audio, and give us your comment. Go right ahead, sir.
K2RIW, KC2SHO, John in Mount Laurel. I came in late, but I do hear what you guys are talking about. Is there a reason that you a small mixer wouldn't be a reasonable solution? This is what I do. And I even have bumped up to 8 radios through the same amplified speaker this way. And then you have audio level controls for every radio. You can even take it a step further, and if you use a stereo one, sometimes you can send some audio to the left speaker, some audio to the right speaker. It's very convenient. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Jonathan. So the mixer circuit you're describing, what brand name, how many dollars, and I think you're saying you're using one that's got 8 inputs, amplified input to either loudspeaker or earphones, if I understand correctly. So tell us how you actually did that, Jonathan. KC2SHO, K2RIW, and TechNet.
Okay, the one I have in front of me right now is a 6-channel analog stereo audio mixer by Realistic. There's RS on the front, also for Radio Shack, obviously. And each line has independent volume control with a master out, with a record out, and also a master out and a record out in stereo, and a mono out as well, all controlled by the master volume. But the monitor is separate. I'm looking at that here. So this is just one particular one. The model number is Realistic model number 32-1210. You can find these on eBay. I highly recommend it.
That Realistic summer mixer common audio circuit that you're describing, roughly how pricey is that, Jonathan? Go ahead.
This may be one of the oldest pieces of gear around here, so I couldn't tell you what you could pay for it now. I'd be happy to look it up on eBay, you know, right now if you wanted me to.
Yeah, that would be nice to know. So I'm convinced it can be done with resistors, where he doesn't need full volume. I mean, he's only using 10% of the audio output capability of the two radios, because earphones are a lot more sensitive than loudspeakers. He might be only using 5%. A network of resistors, a power divider, a purely resistive power divider network, would do the job beautifully. Three resistors would do it. You're doing it a lot more in the Cadillac manner, by which you've got individual volume controls, a common volume control, and so on. Therefore, you don't have to play with the volume control out of each radio. You just leave them all fixed, and maybe even using the line output of the radios, which makes life even simpler. So if that network you're describing is $100, that would be a fun thing to have. If it's $300, it's not so much fun. I'd rather go over to the resistor network. So when you find out, let us know on that one, Jonathan. I'll turn it over to KC2WGB right now for the next one. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
XM with a comment.
XM, go right ahead. Start off with your full call and your name, sir.
Rich, Whiskey Bravo to Golf X-Ray Mike. Another consideration for an audio mixer would be the Behringer mixer. Behringer. There is a variety of inputs and outputs on these Behringer mixers. They're very cheap. You can get them at Guitar Center. You can get them from Sam Ash. You can get them online at musiciansfriend.com, sounds.com, a host of other places. They range from $25 to $80 new. They're very good mixers, very good quality for very low price. WB2GX, I'm out.
Excellent information, Rich. Awful glad you signed in. That sounds like an ideal solution. Behringer mixer. So for $25 to $80, depending on which model you buy. Now you've got an external circuit that keeps all the impedances of your amplifiers happy, keeps your earphones happy, and that's a great way of doing it. Sounds like you've got the solution there, Rich, and I thank you. KC2WGB, K2RIW, you've got it, John.
KC2WGB. Very good. I like the mixer idea myself. I don't know their financial status, so whether they can afford that, but I like the three resistors. And what I believe they're doing, when they have something they want to pay attention to, they just turn the volume down on one radio. I think that's how they're operating. But the mixer, I mean, you know, if he can get something in the range of $50, I think that's the way to go. And he would have a lot better system of operation by just pushing one of the sliders instead of worrying about it. It would be ideal. All the impedances would be correct. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to drop and I shall go on to the next one. And the last one.
Out of $30 now.
That sounds awfully good.
Yeah, that's more better.
The realistic going on eBay here from about $25 to $30. Sometimes a little more, but there's a whole bunch of them for sale. If you look at the current listings, and I'm looking at the completed listings, K4IWKC2SHO. Thanks for letting me make the comments.
Yeah, thank you for your comments, Jonathan. You got it, John. Wait for the beeps.
Yeah, in that range, and they can check that out. $30. I think that's worth the effort. I would recommend that also. Okay, I'll let it drop and go on to the next. KC2WGB. Well, the next question is a little more elaborate, but it's the last one. This gentleman is asking, what is slope detection? What is it used for? And why does it exist? What is the advantage? Is it really used frequently? He's trying to study up on this to find out exactly what's going on. You've spoken about this before, Dick, so maybe you can give him a description and help him out with that. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
In the earlier days of ham radio, where most of the radios you could buy were AM radios, sometimes with a beat frequency oscillator so you could get CW reception, but they had no built-in FM circuitry. So if you were on, I don't know if it was legal on, say, the 40-meter band, I was doing it on the 6-meter band. In other words, I had built myself a homebrew 6-meter converter. No, I was using a commercially made 6-meter converter. Can't think of the brand name right now. It's a company in Queens, New York. A popular brand name. Anyhow, the 6-meter converter I was using would convert 50 megacycle ham band down to the 7 megacycle 40-meter band. So my radio was tuning across 40 meters. And at the beginning, it was a Heathkit AR3. This is way back in the dark ages, a purely AM radio. But I was running narrowband FM transmitter, high power transmitter on 50 megacycles, narrowband FM. And very few radios had a built-in FM demodulator in those days. The way FM works is that your frequency is going to be wiggling back and forth, higher and lower, on the positive and negative half cycles of your speech waveform coming out of that microphone. The positive voltage moves the frequency up, the negative voltage moves it down, and so your frequency output is wiggling around with the audio. That's what FM modulation is. Let me drop. And those old-fashioned AM radios had a 455 KC IF strip, and if you plotted the gain of the IF strip across the frequency, you got a Gaussian-shaped curve, a bell-shaped curve. So if you tune the signal you're listening to a little bit off to one side on the radio, you tune the radio slightly higher or slightly lower than the signal, so that now the signal's center frequency is on the slope of the bell-shaped curve of the IF strip of the radio. Now as the signal wiggles back and forth in frequency, it's climbing up and down that skirt on the right side or the left side of that bell-shaped curve, of the amplitude response of your IF strip. So what that was doing is it was converting the FM into an audio signal that changed in amplitude. And since the radio had an amplitude detector at the far end of the radio, you heard audio. It's not an ideal approach. In other words, it, it doesn't give you the best weak signal threshold, but does allow you to listen to FM signals. I had chosen an FM transmitter. Let me drop. Because I was running a 4CX 250B tube. This was a 500 watt transmitter. And if I was going to run pure AM at 500 watts, I'd have to produce a 250 watt audio amplitude modulator. I didn't want to build the audio 250 watt amplitude modulator. To simply use a Virecta diode way back on the local oscillator stage of the transmitter and wiggle the audio, wiggle the frequency, FM, narrowband FM modulation was very easy to do. It took milliwatts of audio to modulate a 500 watt transmitter. That's the advantage of FM. But the disadvantage was that everyone I talked to on 6 meters with that rig, I had to tell them, tune slightly higher, slightly lower of the frequency so you could hear my audio. Well, with old-fashioned radios, that sort of works. Let me drop. Modern-day ham radios have almost no AM demodulator in them anymore. Scanners, yes, but radios don't. Almost all single sideband. And the single sideband has got a very rectangular-shaped crystal filter to give you ideal response for single sideband. So slope detection with a modern-day sideband receiver is essentially out of the question. It ain't going to sound good, and you're going to be hearing that continuous tone in the background because you can't turn off the tone insert of the quadrature of the product detector that's inside of a sideband receiver. So you can't do slope detection with a modern-day sideband receiver, in my opinion. So it's good to know about. It's something that worked in the old days. Very few people are using narrowband FM high-power transmitters these days. They're using a pure FM rig or a pure sideband rig. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, very good, Dick. Is it possible that you might have some reading material you could recommend? Maybe one of the manuals that are written by either Krause or any of the guys that can give him a better description on that if he wants to get into it?
If you're going into it, you're only doing it for historic reasons. It's a quick and dirty way of listening to an FM signal on a AM radio receiver. You really don't want to do it that way. A real FM demodulator, a Foster-Seeley or ratio detector, does a much, much better job. Much higher in fidelity, much higher in sensitivity. The slope detection approach is something you used out of desperation in those days because you didn't have an FM demodulator, but you wanted to listen to an FM signal. Nobody these days does it that way. So for historic reasons, you could study it if you wanted to. Let me drop. The real good books don't cover it. I don't know of a manual, I don't know of a good historic book that covers the word slope detection. If you Google the word slope detection, I think there's a 90% chance you're going to find a Wikipedia article somewhere that describes the historic situation of slope detection. There is a kind of FM demodulator. I think it's called a Foster-Seeley. No, I can't think of the name of it. There is a kind of FM demodulator which really contains a pair of slope detectors. One slope detector is tuned high, one slope detector is tuned low, and they got two separate diode rectifiers, and two audio amplifiers that are fit together out of phase. And so there is a ratio detector, and...
Was that the Armstrong system, Dick?
It sounds like it. Could be Armstrong. There was a kind of slope detector circuit, which never became very popular. but a real ratio detector or Foster Sealy does a much better job. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, you've given him enough information to get started, but it would be nice if he's that restricted that he might be able to buy something and add it to his AM radio to be able to do that, and he might be able to devise a way to switch it in and out. That might work for him. So I'm sure if he Googles some of that stuff, he can get an idea of a target where to go. Very good. Okay, that's it from the mailbag, Dick. So I'll return it to you, and we'll go over to Paul. Let's see what he's got for us. KC2WGB, Dick.
Yeah, I think one of the astronauts, of the three astronauts that just came up on a Soyuz to the International Space Station, one of them is a lady who is about to break the record for the oldest female in space, and she's about to also exceed, by the end of her mission, she'll be exceeding 400 days in space, so she'll be breaking a number of records of duration and age. So it looks like the usual restriction of astronauts being, very young test pilots. It looks like we're getting way beyond that situation these days. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, with space report number 228, K2LAW. You got it, Paul.
Okay, yeah, Peggy Whitson. Now is on the International Space Station with her two crew members. Launched from Baikonur Kazakhdrome the other day, and 2 days to get there. They dock, they open the door, and they're inside now with the other three. So now there's six on board, and Peggy Whitson is 56 years old. It's the third time up for her. By the way, this is WS2N for the space report. So, they'll spend the next four or five months doing science on the space station. She's up with the commander from the Russian Soyuz MS-3 spacecraft, now docked to the space station. They'll stay docked for the whole time and act as a lifeboat in case there's an emergency. And they'll come back on that same craft. And then she's up there with also a European Space Agency astronaut. Three times up there. The second time, as a commander, she'll be the commander of the International Space Station as well. Let me drop it. So, when she came back last time, they made her in charge of the astronaut corps. You get to assign different people to different missions. And I think she pulled an Alan Shepard. He did the same thing. And Deke Slayton did the same thing. They were in charge. And they said, take me off this, put me back in crew rotation, and I'm going back up. Well, Alan Shepard, who was the first man to go into orbit for the, go into a suborbit for the United States, first man in space, finally got to walk on the moon. And then Deke Slayton, when he was old, they were about the same age as Peggy Whitson. Flew to meet up with the Russians. First meeting of that kind on the Apollo Soyuz mission. So, a lot of old timers would love to go back. Look what John Glenn did many years ago. At 77 years old, he went back up to space on a space shuttle. So, he wanted to check out science behind osteoporosis and all of that, how space affected the elderly. But he got his shot to go back up. He was never happy that they took him out of rotation. Kennedy didn't want to kill off a hero. They didn't want to gamble. Let me drop it. So with that, they have six people on board. They've changed some crew rotations around for the future. The next flight that goes up will have two people on board in March, and the reason for that is the Russians have decided to cut back on their the amount of people that they have on the space station. I know I've talked about this in the past, but you know, if you haven't heard it before, they want to cut back, save some money. They do not have the amount of science to do up there that we do. They were expecting another science module to be delivered to the space station years ago, so that thing's been on hold. And until that ever makes it up there, at that time they will start launching their normal, they usually have at least two astronauts, two cosmonauts on board, but they'll go back to flying three at a time. And at a cost of around $50 to $70 million each, they're not getting any tourists that are going to sign up to go up. So let me drop it. So we're back to five, and at one point or another, we're going to wind up with two for short periods of time. Because if two goes up, the three will eventually go down, and, you know, to be replaced by another three. And at that short period of time, the space station will be manned temporarily by two people, and one of which will always be a cosmonaut, because they're the ones that fly the Soyuz spacecraft, their emergency vehicle to get back out of there. So you always have to have at least one of them. And that, of course, will all change in about a year or two when we eventually start flying from American soil again. We start flying our own people up on the SpaceX Dragon crew version, or the Starliner by Boeing, which is all, you know, both under construction. So that's the story on that. Maybe I'll give you some of the other highlights of the week, and then, you know, if anybody wants to ask any questions, we'll do that. Looks like we have a lot of time. This is WS2X. Okay, the question lately, well, last week and week before, wondering about the elections, is whether or not we're going to have a different kind of NASA. I mainly worry about the economy and things like that, but down on the bottom of the list of the politicians' world is NASA. But, you know, they have a lot bigger budgets to be concerned with, you know, with defense and military. NASA, a lot of people think, is this big, overbloated budget, but it's really only about a little less than one half of 1% of the federal budget. So a lot of people right now would like to see that maybe increased. One guy that called for that is this guy Bigelow, Robert Bigelow. Which of course, I agree with him, but he would love to see the budget doubled. He knows he's not going to get that, I'm sure, but there's talk about a lot of the people that are going to be appointed. Some of those people are in favor of a more human flight. One guy in particular wants to would like to do what I wanted to do last week, is go back to the moon and maybe start designing an outpost on the moon, but keep the Martian program going. We have that going with Obama. He really put the gas to the metal on that, on the SLS, the Space Launch System. So I'd like to see that keep going, and I think it will. Let me drop it. There's a couple of advisors that, you know, that they've talked about that are interested in the space program. They're not too crazy about all the climate satellites that go up. We have many satellites going up, and that's, a lot of it's coming under NASA budget, but a lot of it's not. Some of it is put under the NOAA budget. For instance, we had a launch the other day. I just watched it go up. Yesterday was a GOES satellite. It was a night launch. It was just after dark. And a GOES R satellite. Anybody that doesn't know, the GOES satellites are our big geosynchronous weather satellites. And we've had them up since like the 1970s. And they're always staring down, looking at the hurricanes. You're looking for the weather report, and you see a hurricane. I'm dropping. WS2S. Well, they've upgraded the GOES satellite, the future GOES satellite. This one was called GOES R, and it's like five times faster in scanning the Earth. The resolution is increased by about four times. They have other equipment on board that they really never had before. This lightning, check out how many lightning bolts there are. There's other cameras staring at the sun, looking at solar explosions that happen in all these coronal expulsions that happen on the sun. But the main thing, of course, is staring back at the Earth, especially for tornadoes and hurricanes. And they really made an improvement on this thing. It's a large satellite. I mean, it looks like it's about 30 feet tall. I mean, one guy stands next to it, one big solar panel. And they successfully launched that on an Atlas V. It was a 5-4-1 configuration. And let me drop it. And when it comes to the Atlas launches, when they use those numbers 5-4-1, for instance, they'll have different variations. The 5-4-1 means that the fairing, the diameter of the fairing, before a satellite opens up, they compress it and they put it inside the fairing. Well, the fairing is 5 meters in diameter. Gives you an idea of how big this thing is. And that's folded up. And the 4 stands for how many solid boosters are attached to it. Sometimes there's none, so you would have a 5-0-1, 5-2-1, or 5-3-1. And in this case, it was a 5-4-1. And the 1 at the end it's always been a 1 because there's a 1 upper stage, and it's a Centaur rocket. It's an AJ-10 hydrogen oxygen rockets that they've used, probably upgraded, over the decades, but probably 500 times, and a very successful rocket by Aerojet. So it went up with a 5-4-1 configuration. Give you an idea, the one that went to Pluto, New Horizons, was a 5-5-1, so that had 5 solid booster rockets on it. Let me drop it. OSIRIS-REx, that just went up. We talked about that last couple of weeks. That's on the way to that asteroid, and it had a 4-1-1. That means it had a 4-meter diameter fairing up on top. It had only one booster attached to it, and again, one Centaur upstage. So when you see those numbers, that's pretty much what they mean. Gives you an idea of how big these things are. Now there's going to be a GOES S, T, and a U. There's 3 more GOES satellites to follow. Now, being climatic type of satellites, you often wonder if the next administration would like to cancel it. But I don't think they can because all these contracts are drawn up years ago and they've been working on it, so they probably won't be. They'll be launched. And I would guess, anyway, hurricane and tornado satellites are very important. Some of the other ones I think we might see, we might lose them. But this thing got up there successfully. It'll take about 2 weeks to actually get to its final orbit, and about a year of calibrating and working on it before it becomes operational. Let me drop it. Many other topics to talk about, Dick, so I don't want to, drag it out, but we have probably, I have an upgrade on the Pathfinder mission that we talked about months ago that went up. Talk about the Chinese, they came back, they brought their astronauts back from the space station. What have you. You have any questions or anybody else, Dick? K2RIW, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. And by the way, my email, if anybody wants to contact me, is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick.
You mentioned that the OSIRIS-REx, that's the one that's going to go to an asteroid, is a 411 launch, 4-meter diameter fairing. One rocket booster is under that particular stage. And then the next one, I think it's telling me that the next stage only has one rocket engine. I'm having trouble believing that that massive thing left the ground with just one rocket engine. So is there really another number missing, like 4115? So the bottom booster really has five rockets on it. Give me a few more words on that OSIRIS-REx, sir. Call WSUN, KQIW.
Okay, yeah, that's the number. Once you understand the Atlas V rocket system, the Atlas V rocket, you could have a regular Atlas V with no booster rockets, no solid booster rockets attached at all, and which they've launched plenty of them. And what that is just one RD-180 engine that's mounted to the bottom of the rocket, and that gives you your main thrust. I think it's in the 500,000 to 600,000 pound category of thrust. So that's your standard Atlas V. Then you could attach one booster on it, one solid booster attached to it, to the side of it, which falls off after about a minute and a half. It drops off and it continues along on its RD-180. By the way, RD-180 is your standard RP fuel, which is a purified kerosene, filtered, kerosene fuel, and then with also liquid oxygen. Now that keeps pushing, in that case, OSIRIS-REx, almost out of Earth orbit. I mean, it pushes it for about a minute and a half, and it gets it into what you would consider the beginning of Earth orbit. Now, the Centaur upper stage, Centaur, I think they call them the Centaur D now. They've gone through different iterations, so more upgraded one. Is a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen upper stage rocket, and that pushes it in that case, out of Earth orbit.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
To put it in last launch, the GO satellite, Centaur has to fly it three different times to get it to where it's going. Back either.
Okay, OSIRIS-REx is launched with a Atlas V 411. You said the bottom stage has this massive engine, and it's got a solid rocket booster, just one solid rocket booster that drops away. That sounds like it would be an unbalanced blast. In other words, one solid rocket booster off to one side of the main rocket engine. I'm having trouble believing that's a balanced system. If you had two solid rocket boosters, one on the north side and one on the south side, that's a balanced solid rocket booster system. But just one solid rocket booster plus the main center engine, that doesn't sound balanced. Give me some more words on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Isn't that something? This is the third time they've done that with different launches. And if I listened to the press conference. They always have a press conference with some of these bigger launches, and they'll put four or five guys on a dais and ask them questions. And there's always a guy in charge of ULA, United Launch Alliance, which is a combination of Boeing and Lockheed, and they're the ones that launch all these things. They launched the Atlas, and they launched the Deltas. They used to launch the old Delta IIs, and now they're retired. And sure enough, that's a question that came up. And they said it's a standard procedure. It's part of the system. Then you could have two, you could have three, and then you had five. You had five with New Horizons. You had four with Curiosity. think you would have five, but you had four. So, yeah, they have it designed where it does work, and then one just drops off. It's really strange looking when you watch it go up.
If the main center engine, which I think is a liquid engine, is going to give you clean thrust, and you've got a solid rocket booster on one side, if I put the solid rocket booster on the south side of the rocket, so to speak, it's going to make it curve toward the north. It's an unbalanced thrusting system. Unless the center liquid-fueled rocket engine is heavily gimbaled to the south, that's the only way I can stop it from making a curved orbit. And now if that center engine is heavily gimbaled, it means its thrust direction is not parallel to the thrust of the solid rocket booster. So therefore, there's a little bit of the system fighting itself. It's a little bit less efficient. I'm having a lot of trouble believing that one single solid rocket booster on one side of the main takeoff engine gives you a balanced thrust without a hell of a lot of gimbaling of that engine, of the liquid engine. WS2N, K2RIW, Great Ball.
I know the 180, RD-180s are gimbaled. You know, they are gimbaled. They can do the pitch and the UR, and no problem. And I think to some degree these solid booster rockets are too. I wouldn't be surprised if they're gimbaled in some way. Or maybe they're just pointed at a certain way at takeoff. I don't know. But, yeah, it does work. I guess it's, I don't know, similar to the jets, the old planes that used to use a rocket to take off from a runway, short runway. You know, basically they had one rocket, you know, sitting on the bottom of the jet, and the plane, you know, to help it take off. No, I haven't studied the physics behind it, but I know it definitely works. And that was one of the flights. And you can see takeoff, if you bring up, Osiris Rex Launch on, even YouTube has it. You already have to bring up NASA, but you can see takeoff, it's pretty strange. Back to you, Dick.
With some of that thrust of the solid rocket booster being off to one side of the center line of the total spaceship on takeoff, the only way you can stop it from curving, not flying straight, is to use a whole lot of gimbaling. When you're gimbaling one or two engines, either the solid rocket booster and the liquid, or maybe only the liquid, but when you're gimbaling that engine, in order to keep it flying straight, even though you have non-symmetric thrust, the net result is that as you first take off from the launch pad, you don't fly straight up. You start sliding across the launch pad because of the gimbaling. That must be a strange-looking takeoff. When you actually watch the takeoff from the pad, do you see it sort of slide across the pad as the first starts lifting because of that gimbaling action? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh, it looks like it goes straight up. And same type of thing with the five solid boosters that they use for New Horizons. You know, it goes up, and there's one. It's not like they're evenly put around the whole rocket. You know, it's like they're almost like they have three on one side, two on the other. And even with this last launch, the GOES-R that went up, that has, you know, it's even, you know, two on one side, two on the other, but, you know, you think they would evenly space them apart, but they don't. And when they get up, you know, you see the two disconnect after about a minute and a half, and then a second and a half later, the other two separate. It's that quick. But, I don't know, they got their act together. They've launched, I think they said 68 versions of the Atlas, not the different versions, but 58 Atlas V's with, you know, a lot of different versions, you know, some with one, some with two. When they start launching the Starliner with the crew on board, it's going on top of the same Atlas. Let me drive them. That will be...